This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 29, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Congress is set to return from recess next week, and the warrantless wiretapping program is on the top of their agenda. Workers in Chile demand a fair share of the country's economic boom. And it's been 2 years since Hurricane Katrina struck and devastated the Gulf Coast. We'll hear from the coast and beyond. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. The Washington Post is reporting that President Bush is seeking additional funding for the war in Iraq to the tune of $50 billion. That's in addition to the $460 billion defense budget for fiscal year 2008. And beyond the $147 billion war supplemental bill pending before Congress. The White House is expected to combine the funding request with the pending war supplemental in order to make a single request for roughly $200 billion. In contrast, White House figures released today show that the federal government has disbursed or made available a total of $96 billion for Hurricane Katrina recovery. If today's Washington Post front-page story is accurate, the Bush administration's September request for additional war funding will total to more than twice the amount of federal funding that's been made available for post-Katrina recovery along the entire affected Gulf Coast. A flurry of activity is taking place today around the case of Texas death row inmate Kenneth Foster. Foster is scheduled to die tomorrow evening for a murder the state of Texas concedes he did not commit. Foster received a death sentence under a controversial Texas law that essentially makes anyone tied to a murder by association responsible for the murder. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles is to rule on the case for clemency this afternoon. A last-minute appeal is also pending before the Supreme Court. Art Laffin is a member of Murder Victims Families for Human Rights, a death penalty abolition group organizing a vigil today in front of the Supreme Court.
The case of Kenneth Foster is especially egregious in that this man was the driver of a car. He had nothing to do with this murder. He had no foreknowledge of the murder. He's been on death row for 10 years. He's a little daughter. And now the state of Texas is planning to execute him. And we're going to be at the Supreme Court from 4:30 to 6 this afternoon, praying and making an urgent emergency appeal to the Supreme Court justices to do the right thing, to act in the principles of justice and compassion and mercy, and to grant a stay of execution for Kenneth Foster.
Kenneth Foster is the third person scheduled for execution this week on Texas death row. Amnesty International USA calls the scheduled execution a, quote, new low for Texas. In Ontario, a dispute between Indigenous protesters and a Canadian mining corporation has reached a new level of tension. FSRN's Stefan Christophe reports from Montreal.
Algonquin protesters set up a blockade 2 months ago along a road leading towards disputed territory in Ontario, after learning that the Canadian mining corporation Frontenac Ventures planned to begin operations on the land. The proposed uranium mine is unpopular both with Native and non-Native local communities. Ontario mining laws stipulate that a corporation can explore territory for a potential mine after informing provincial authorities of their intent. Algonquin community leaders say they never received prior notification of the mining company's plans. They argue that the lack of communication on the matter constitutes a violation of Canadian law regarding Indigenous land claims. Lawyer Christopher Reed represents the Algonquin in this case.
This is Aboriginal title land, which is protected under Section 35 of Canada's Constitution. The Algonquin people have never surrendered their land. They've lived on this land, occupied it, used it, and governed it since long before any settlers arrived here.
Despite past legal precedent, an Ontario judge this week ordered that the mining corporation, Frontenac Ventures, shall have immediate, unfettered access to the property. The Algonquin demonstrators plan to remain at the protest camp on the access road and have vowed to keep the mining company out of their territory. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Stefan Christophe in Montreal.
In Guatemala, another candidate for public office has been assassinated on the campaign trail. Casillas City Council candidate Clara Luz López was shot dead yesterday while on her way home. Ms. López was with the Encuentro por Guatemala political party, led by Nobel laureate and presidential candidate Rigoberta Menchú. More than 50 people have been assassinated in political killings since the start of the campaign season in May, making it Guatemala's bloodiest campaign season since the Civil War. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Yes. It came in from the Gulf. Oh. It took my people down. Yes, it came in from the Gulf, and it took my people down. I destroyed New Orleans town.
On August 29, 2005, Hurricane Katrina spawned the widespread evacuation and destruction of much of the Gulf Coast region. The storm surge breached the levee system in New Orleans, flooding the low-lying poorer portions of the city. It left 238 people dead in Mississippi and flooded miles into Alabama, leaving well over 500,000 residents without electrical power. In addition, the surge revealed the ugliness of racism and class-based inequalities for the world to see. It was one of the costliest and deadliest natural disasters to ever hit the United States. 2 years later, 80% of the public housing units in New Orleans remain closed. The African-American population is less than half of what it was before Katrina, and 65% of New Orleans schools are closed. President Bush visited several schools in New Orleans today, saying that the city is, quote, coming back, while those living in the city are telling a very different story. The Southern Education Foundation released a report today saying not since the Great Depression has the United States witnessed so many of its own students out of school. FSRN's Karen Miller reports that for the educational system, the road to recovery continues to be a long one.
Children returning to school in New Orleans this fall will face a vastly different school system than before Hurricane Katrina. In November 2005, the state of Louisiana assumed control of 107 out of 128 schools in the New Orleans district. Immediately, the state began converting many of its newly acquired schools to charter schools. F. Howard Nelson from the American Federation of Teachers says this is where the problem began.
Well, the basic attempt was to turn every school into a charter school, but that just didn't happen. And it was also evident that in order to have charter schools, you need a separate set of schools that are sort of schools of last resort, that they'll take kids at any time of the year, they'll take kids with disabilities. And so this sort of separate school system called the Recovery School District was established.
Critics like Nelson charge that these recovery schools are among the worst.
Even though there are a lot of disparities, inequalities before Katrina, it's actually gotten worse, where you have some elite charter schools on one end, and then on the other end, you have schools that are disorganized, chaotic, run with no central administration.
The Bush administration, however, continues to push charter schools as the way to go. In fact, immediately after the flood, President Bush attempted a $500 million voucher program, which would have diverted funds from the public school system and put it in the form of a voucher into parents' hands so that displaced children could enroll in private and religious schools across the country. Critics saw the move as an attempt to exploit the disaster to finally enact vouchers, a long-standing Bush goal. Lynn Huntley with the Southern Education Foundation today released a report saying that the federal government's response to rebuilding education infrastructure has been inadequate.
We do a lot of good talking in this country about caring about children, about the importance of education for the economy, for civic life, for democracy, for fairness. But in fact, in reality, we rely on local taxes primarily to fund public education, P through 12, and Louisiana and Mississippi don't have the money.
The report says donations to public and private schools from other countries have equaled the amount given by the federal government. Hunley says it is still not enough, although some students will fare better than others.
Those children who were re-enrolling in the charter schools, who tend to be the more affluent students and who were the students who meet admissions requirements, probably will have a decent chance of resuming a fairly normal educational course. Those who are in the public schools for all other children, which are predominantly low income and predominantly minority, will have a much tougher road to hoe.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
What happens when your community doesn't receive the assistance it needs to rebuild homes and move residents back after a huge natural disaster? What happens when the only union work available is for, quote, able-bodied men? Well, if you're like the women of the Moore Community House in Gulfport, Mississippi, you train your community in construction work and begin doing it yourself. LaWanda White has this report from Gulfport.
It's almost 2 years since Hurricane Katrina, and all around the Gulf Coast, houses are still standing empty.
I feel like after 2 years, I would say at least 60% should be built back. But you look around, there's so much obstacles we have to face. And it's like, oh, man, when are we ever going to reach that bridge?
Like me, Monica Connolly lives in Gulfport, Mississippi.
And I know people get tired of us talking about Hurricane Katrina, but we really didn't get enough help in a good time frame. We wouldn't be talking about it after 2 years if everything would have came out the way it's supposed to. And then we really wouldn't have nothing to complain about.
Monica isn't complaining. She's not waiting for help. She's taking reconstruction into her own hands, thanks to a new construction training program.
Well, I decided to take this because I want to be able to do my own repairs at my house and cut the labor costs down and to have a good career, long-term career, because if you look around, Mississippi is going to have a long ways to build back.
Brody Walker, Monica's teacher, says the construction industry is booming since the storm.
Well, there's definitely a lot more work down here, and there's a lot more work that we still have to do, and it's going to take a collective effort.
Our collective effort is a little short on women. Monica is one of just two women in the training course. And despite the desperate need for skilled labor, women aren't necessarily welcome on job sites. Brody Walker.
We still live in an age where we have, you know, male chauvinists, and they think that the woman's place is basically at home and not on the construction field. We still have that type of mentality.
That mentality might come from years of male domination in the construction industry. With so much left to rebuild, the Gulf Coast is opening up new opportunities for women in construction. Regina Phillips is the single parent coordinator for Hands On America. She says, with most jobs, women can't make ends meet.
It's not really a whole lot of jobs that are good paying jobs for women.
The construction industry does offer a living wage, and more women like this client of Regina Phillips are finding jobs in the building trades.
She started out as a laborer making $10 an hour, and now she's doing something else where she's making, I think, $15, $16 an hour, and she said you can even go up from there.
These women are changing more than the industry. Remember Monica in the building training program? She says that now the men in her life see her a little different.
My kids will look up to me like, "Ooh, mama built this," or "mama did this." And it's like, yeah, 99 I can show my brothers I did it. So I don't need you. I don't have to call you. I can do it myself.
Kaya Blaylock is also in the Home Builders Institute program with Monica. She wishes more women would take on construction.
It's very empowering to let a male counterpart know that, you know, I am just as good as you. You know, I could do this too.
As a matter of fact, there are some unique strengths that women bring to the job. Quincy Davis is a site supervisor for Hands On, a volunteer organization rebuilding homes on the Gulf Coast. We visited her on a job site where she was working with her all-female crew.
One of my guy volunteers was caulking a doorway, and I was sort of pointing out how, you know, it's hard to get the caulk all smooth in the corners, so you have to sort of use your pinky. And he looked at me, he's like, yeah, except your pinky's a little bit smaller than mine is, you know. Sometimes it is actually easier if you have smaller hands to be able to do things. And I think it's important to help women understand that they're not at a disadvantage.
Too many women don't understand that yet. Kaya Blaylock has a message for women who are interested in construction but are sitting on the sidelines.
Don't second guess yourself. Go with your first mind. If this is what you want to do, go for it all the way.
In Gulfport, Mississippi, I'm LaWanda White with Carissa McClain.
The International Tribunal on Hurricanes Katrina and Rita kicks off in New Orleans today. Organizers say they created the five-day hearing to hold the U.S. government and President Bush accountable for failures before, during, and after the storm. We're joined on the line by Kojo Livingston. He's an organizer with the People's Hurricane Relief Fund. Let's start off by talking a little bit about accountability. Why did you feel that it was necessary 2 years after Katrina struck to hold this tribunal? And what are some of the most pressing questions that you're asking today?
For the tribunal itself, there's a big question as to why this was allowed to happen. Every credible source conceivable warned the government that the levees needed to be repaired and needed to be fixed. The money was there. The money has been there for the entire 20, 30-year period that various groups and universities have done the studies. There's no logical explanation for, one, why there was such a callous disregard for human life and safety on the part of the government. Number two, the refusal of the government to rescue people in a timely fashion once they were in. There's the issue of rendition, people being taken places where they did not want to go. When the buses came, people did not know where they were being taken. Families were separated. We still have, at least at our last count, nearly 200 children who haven't been united with their families yet. There are a number of things like that. And then, of course, you know, it's 2 years and people are saying get over it. If you come look through the city, you'll understand why folks haven't gotten over it. The city hasn't gotten over it. Nations have been built in less time than it looks like it's going to take to rebuild this one city. That is not because of a lack of intellect. It's not because of a lack of resources. That's because of a lack of will or, you know, a sinister and insidious agenda on the part of people in power.
And what do you plan on doing with the findings from this tribunal?
The findings are going to be taken. A panel is going to actually come up with some findings, and then we're going to publicize that and use that as part of appeal to the United Nations and to the world community to get formally involved in calling the United States to account for the crimes that have been committed against the people in the Gulf Coast. And we want to engage the world community in actively calling the United States into account for this so that some form of righteous restitution is made, but also so that what has happened to us in the Gulf Coast never happens to anyone again. If you've experienced this with my family, one day we had things and the next day we had nothing. 30 years of possessions in our marriage were gone. We don't want anyone to experience that. No, we don't want anyone to ever have to experience the lethargy of social service agencies and charitable groups and the government agencies in responding either to people who are in the midst of crisis or in the aftermath of a disaster. No one should ever, ever have to go through this again. And whatever it takes to correct that illness within the government of the United States, that's what we want to see happen. And we want to be a part of making that happen.
Kojo Livingston is an organizer with the People's Hurricane Relief Fund. The International Tribunal on Hurricanes Katrina and Rita continues through the 2nd of September in New Orleans. Congress is set to return to Washington next week, and one of the top priorities on their agenda will be to look at the warrantless surveillance program. Civil liberties groups are pressuring Congress to, as they say, fix what they broke. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Democrats promised to revise controversial legislation they passed just hours before they left for the summer break that gives the administration broad authority to wiretap communications of some Americans when one end of the line is international. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office says the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees will begin addressing options when they return on Tuesday. In a letter to the chairs of the Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is urging them to do the same. And in the meantime, he directed them to set up oversight mechanisms. Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee Patrick Leahy could bring up contempt of Congress citations against the administration for not adhering to subpoena requests regarding the warrantless program. But civil rights activists can't believe they have to prepare for a huge battle in Washington.
Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi running Congress, and you had people who were euphoric after their victories because they thought that this meant that these terrible civil liberties policies would be changed and that there would be forward motion. And then all of a sudden you see them schedule legislation. Sure, they voted against it, but I think you have to understand where the base is coming from, what the power of leadership is. That's the power to set the agenda. That means that they can actually decide what goes to the floor.
That was Caroline Fredrickson, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU has a newspaper advertisement running in Reid and Pelosi's districts, targeting their role in passing the administration's legislation.
Trying to show members of Congress that this is a voting issue, as much as the economy or the war or anything else, preserving the Constitution is a voting issue.
Nita Chattery is with MoveOn.org. 250,000 MoveOn members have signed on to a petition for civil liberties that they'll distribute to Congress. But the legislation expires in 6 months. But Julian Sanchez with Reason Magazine says the administration is going into the debate many steps ahead because it's on their terms.
One of the problems with sunsets is that while they're regarded as a kind of check, what often it seems happens, and I think the experience with the Patriot Act is a case in point, is that legislation that would never be approved if it were regarded as permanent kind of slips under because it's regarded as something that's a stopgap. The problem is that the institutional momentum then shifts. 6 months later, the question is not, should we reapprove this vast expansion of surveillance power? It's, if you don't reapprove it, why do you want to impose novel limits on our intelligence gathering capability?
Access for information on the program is minimal. The Congress has failed to get pertinent documents. The ACLU is awaiting a Friday deadline that could provide them with key classified court documents that could provide the public with the most insight yet into the surveillance program. Some civil liberties advocates say that until more information is known, it might be best to let the surveillance updates expire, which would bring it back to the way it was before, within the jurisdiction of the judicial branch and where a warrant is necessary to wiretap Americans. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Global demand for copper is steadily growing, and as the world's largest copper exporter, Chile's economy is booming. The country's gross domestic product has nearly doubled to $140 billion since 2000, and the per capita income is now $8,500 a year. Of course, per capita income is a statistic. The reality behind that is that 10% of Chilean workers earn a minimum wage of around $273 per month. That's a little over $3,000 a year. And a government minister told the Chile U.S. Chamber of Commerce yesterday that about 80% of the workforce earns less than what's considered an ethical wage of about $500 a month, about $6,000 a year. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago, Chile, on growing demands for a fair share of the boom.
Chile has never been as rich as it is now. The economy is growing, exports are up, business profits are climbing. But despite the country's growth, the real wages continue to be increasingly low when compared with the economic growth. Workers are demanding their fair share, and in the past few months, there have been a number of protracted and difficult strikes in the important copper industry and forestry sector. National Union President Arturo Martinez says simply workers have had enough of a raw deal.
Mala salud, mala educación, mala...
We have endured poor health care, bad education, bad pensions, low wages, and political and social exclusion. We are no longer willing to tolerate these conditions. We want a country for all, not only for the politicians in power and those who have economic power.
His sentiments are echoed on the streets. Most people agree the minimum wage is not enough to meet the rising cost of living.
It is bad. Of course it is too little. The average Chilean has two or three children. Usually the women do not work. So I think it's low, definitely too low.
Well, minimum wage is a disgrace to the country because with the ongoing price increases, one cannot make ends meet. It is not enough to pay rent for a decent home. It is not enough to feed a family, which forces both parents to go out to work. The minimum wage rate is not enough to live here in Chile.
Demonstrations across the country today in support of higher wages and against the free market policies have put the center-left government of socialist president Michelle Bachelet on the defensive. Bachelet takes issue with those who question her government's commitment to increase and enhance the social safety net.
I do not accept the criticism of my government's commitment and my own commitment to social justice. I ask that our gains be measured with reason and maturity. We are working on solving our problems. We have to discuss and build and not to dwell on complaints and criticism. As the head of state, I will work tirelessly towards reaching the greatest commitment for social justice faster and sooner.
The center-left coalition that has ruled the country since its return to democracy in 1990 has made progress in developing a strong safety net, but it has governed with free market economic policies that keep wages low. The coalition governments have nearly eradicated extreme poverty, the poverty line has decreased to 13%, and the Bachelet government is helping to bridge the serious income gap indirectly with subsidies to heating, improved housing conditions, and improved public education and healthcare. But as analyst Raúl Sor says, these measures are not enough. He says workers want their fair share of the country's wealth.
I would say that many workers, in a way, have had enough of what they feel is a very raw deal they've been getting from their employers. Judging by the previous government attitudes, I think there won't be a great change. I mean, they promised that they would pay $2 extra a month if the country had a growth of 5.8% through the year. Then workers would get an extra $2 a month, which really, it's peanuts.
As unions and workers continue to push for improved real wages, business leaders caution that if wages are pushed too high, many small and medium-sized companies would have to close because they could not afford a major increase in wages. The government appears to agree with that view, so workers will have to continue organizing to make their demands for decent wages a reality. If today's mobilization does not yield results, then union leaders will call for a national strike. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Music breaks in today's newscast were produced by Ian Hunter, Craig Klein, and Brian Lee. They're all part of the New Orleans Musicians Relief Fund. For Puck Lowe, Monica Lopez, Tina Gysi, Shannon Young, Leanne Caldwell, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz, I'm Ara Bogado at Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA.